Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Katie Simpson Smith, whose gorgeous new novel is The Story of Land and Sea. We'll also hear from Nicholas Meese, author of New Orleans Hurricanes from the Start. It's rare indeed that an author has a year like Katie Simpson Smith is having. First, there was the publication of a serious scholarly work, We Have Raised All of You, Motherhood in the South, 1750 to 1835, from LSU Press. And now comes one of the season's most talked about debut novels, The Story of Land and Sea, heralded in a big spread in Vogue magazine and appearing on many of the fall's must-read lists. Welcome to The Reading Life, Katie.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And congratulations.
Thank
you. This is a big deal. Now, you grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, which is a great place for a storyteller to come from. Did you know it would be that kind of gift in your life, that background?
I have been writing stories since I was very tiny, and I think living in Jackson made me feel like that was possible. Everyone around me had stories, and the people in our lives that, you know, who the libraries were named after and who we talked about as sort of mythic figures were Eudora Welty and Richard Wright and William Faulkner and Margaret Walker Alexander. So there was this sense that literature was a serious endeavor and that all of us could participate in it, which I think is rare in a lot of cities. And so I am very grateful to Jackson for giving me that upbringing.
And both your parents were professors?
They are, yes. My mother teaches art history and my father teaches philosophy and religion.
Oh, girl, that's something to live up to.
I know.
But I like what you say about Jackson, because I think sometimes it is useful just to have writing be such an accepted part of life.
Right.
You know, Richard Ford talks about how I think his mother would point out to him, that's Eudora Welty, she's a writer, as if a writer were just a fine thing to be.
Exactly.
You know? So then you went off to Mount Holyoke, and then you got a PhD at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But then instead of sticking with academic life, you took a sharp turn to creative writing and went to Bennington.
Yes, I'd scampered away from academia. I loved my history program, and it offered me a way to tell stories that were true. And so I had to back everything up and use citations and find these kernels of reality in the past. But while I was doing that, I was so struck with how little I could get into people's emotions. And that was what was most important to me. And so I realized that the writing life was one that I needed to explore further. And I never knew if it would take off or if I would be any good at it, but I needed to try. And so moving from UNC Chapel Hill to Bennington was just like moving into a completely different world. And as soon as I got there, I realized it was the perfect fit for me.
And you had teachers there who obviously made a difference in your life.
Oh my gosh, the faculty there are amazing, so talented. They're at the top of their game, but they're also genuinely generous and warm-hearted people, which I didn't expect. And so I've formed incredibly wonderful friendships with them that still last.
So tell me, to go back to your history life, your life as an historian, how did you choose motherhood as an area of study? That's so interesting.
That's an excellent question. I was very interested in women's history, and particularly this time period of the American Revolution. And I wanted to look at those lives that were otherwise excluded from the historical record. So not just the white women that everyone hears about because they write letters, but also the poorer women, the enslaved women, Native American women. And motherhood seems to be this universal thing in women's lives that tied everyone together. Whether you were rich or you were poor, most women at that time period experienced childbirth. And so by diving into that, I was then able to see all this diversity in women's lives, that motherhood meant such different things to these women, and yet that it was a source of pride and of power for all of them.
And that's what's so interesting in We Have Raised All of You, that use of power in whatever sphere was available. It's a fascinating book.
Oh, thank you.
But yeah, the story of Land and Sea is so much about fatherhood.
Right.
You know, it's beset in much the same time period.
Right.
But fatherhood for a change.
I think I'm still just trying to explore what I don't know. And so I haven't been a mother, and so looking at motherhood was a way to explore that. And then for the novel, I thought, what greater challenge could there be to write about than fatherhood? I'm so removed from that. And yet it's such a huge part of family life, and especially during this time period when mothers were dying during childbirth, so many men were left alone to raise children. And that dynamic is so interesting to me.
So tell us a little bit about the story of Land and Sea and the plot of this novel.
Sure. It's a story about three generations of family. So you have a father named John who's raising his 10-year-old daughter on the coast of North Carolina during the end years of the Revolution. And he is uncertain about how best to raise her, given that her mother has died. And he used to be a pirate on the high seas, is a little bit ill-equipped for fatherhood. But it's also the story of his wife, and we see her childhood before she grows up and meets John. And she is given a slave girl for her 10th birthday called Moll. And the relationship between Moll and Helen is one of the key relationships in the book. There's a lot of tension there, but also this sort of unspoken love for each other that's always colored by the power dynamic of slavery. Mm-hmm. And then finally, it's the story of Asa, who is Helen's father, and who deals with the grief of losing not only his daughter, but also eventually his granddaughter, and how all of these individuals cope with loss.
And it's a landscape that is really richly rendered, too. What is it about this landscape that drew you in as a place?
I took a lot of road trips when I was in North Carolina for my PhD, and one of my very favorite places to go is the North Carolina coast, which is so beautiful and wild still. And it has this marvelous quality of being very liminal. It's not totally beach and then ocean. It's marsh and it's these prairies. And there's a sense that the land just sort of drifts off into the ocean instead of fully stopping. And that uncertainty and the way the land works with the water and moves with the water was very evocative to me of these characters' lives and how uncertain they are as well.
And what about this time period?
I am not sure why I'm so attached to the late 18th century. I keep coming back to it as a source of study. I think it has to do with the way that America is trying to define itself at this period. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of possibility across the board that we have not yet determined who we will be as a nation. And so characters still have a lot of room to maneuver in their own lives and to decide, this is the man I'm going to be, or this is the religion I will follow, or these are the political beliefs I will espouse. And that's a very rich territory for me.
And it's never superimposed on the story. It's so organic as you're reading this novel. And these ideas about slavery are so fascinating, that friendship between Helen and Moll and what it means that they are such friends and yet one belongs to the other.
Right. You can't escape the power there. And one of the things I really wanted to do with this novel was to show a side of slavery that readers might not be as familiar with. This is not your large-scale cotton plantation. This is a woman who lives on a very small plantation with very few other slaves. And so she's in a particular position of closeness with the white people she lives with. And yet, despite that, there's still this constant overlayer of control in her life. She is forced to marry a man against her will. And even though we might see her owners as quote-unquote kind for the time period.
Right. Now, one of the things about this book that I admire so much is that the style is so simple and so lovely, and it has gravitas. These lives and losses are so real and so serious, and the reader's utterly, you know, transported to that time and place. So what was it like for you to find your voice as a novelist after writing all that history with just the facts?
Yeah, that's a great question. The issue of finding one's voice, I think, never fully stops. You're always looking for it. With this particular novel, I think I was helped by all of the research that I did for my dissertation. So I read hundreds of letters and diaries and accounts from slave owners and plantation records. And so there's this sort of lilting rhythm of the 18th century that got into my head. And it was very easy for me to just sort of lay it out on the page and say, this is how these people would have spoken because this is how these people thought. These were their morals and their values. And that was the fun part, to sort of find the language that fit, but that also revealed their innermost thoughts and feelings.
Well, there's so much beautiful stuff in this novel. So read us a little bit so we'll have a sense of what it sounds like to hear your fictional voice. Let's hear from the beginning of the story of Land and Sea.
On days in August when sea storms bite into the North Carolina coast, he drags a tick mattress into the hall and tells his daughter stories, true and false, about her mother. The wooden shutters clatter, and Tabitha folds blankets around them to build a softness for the storm. He always tells of their courting days, of her mother's shyness. She looked like a straight, tall pine from a distance. Only when he got close could he see her trembling. Was she scared? Happy, John says. We were both happy. He watches Tab pull the quilt up to her chin, though even the storm can't blow away the heat of summer. She is waiting to hear his secrets. But it is hard to describe how it feels to stand next to someone you love on the shore at dusk. He didn't have to see Helen to know she was there. Something in her body pulled at something in his across the humid air between them. When you're older, he says, and she nods, familiar with this response. Why don't you ever tell about the ship, she asks, all the things you must have seen with her. He looks down the hall at the shadows whipping across the slats and holds a finger to his lips. Can you hear any birds? Tab slips into the kitchen for an end of bread in the darkness of the storm. She will keep asking him until he tells her. In the quilts again, she tucks close against him. As the wind rattles through the palmettos and the rain melts the window glass, John sings one of his sailing tunes to soothe her. Tabitha calls out, "Louder!" and he rises to his feet, unsteady on the mattress, waving his browned hands to the melody. His voice carries through the quiet rooms.
That has one of the loveliest descriptions of being in love with someone I've ever heard.
Thank you.
It's really lovely. We've been talking with historian and novelist Katie Simpson Smith, whose two new books are We Have Raised All of You, Motherhood in the South, 1750 to 1835, and this gorgeous new novel, The Story of Land and Sea. You can meet Katie Wednesday, September 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Columns Hotel, 3811 St. Charles Avenue, at an event sponsored by Maple Street Bookshop, and again Thursday, September 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Katie.
Thank you.
Nicholas Meese was a longtime civil engineering draftsman before he turned to technical writing. After Katrina, he worked on some of the most important documents generated by the Army Corps of Engineers and became a periodic inspection coordinator with the Corps. Now, with David Bastian, he is the co-author of New Orleans Hurricanes from the Start. Welcome to The Reading Life, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So here we are in the middle of hurricane season, with a book that looks back at the whole story. So tell us how this book came about.
Back in 2006, Dave Bastian and I were working together on a number of documents, like you said. And part of that was to help the scientists create computer models so that they could make predictions on how to design the repairs and the new structures and all. And part of that, Dave was tasked to go back into the past and add information from as far back as we could go. And he discovered that we didn't have any real official records further back than 1851 or so.
And you know, in New Orleans, that's just yesterday.
That's right. Yeah, it is. And so he took it upon himself to just on his own see if there was any records that went back to the early colonial days. And he did find some, but they're not what you would call reliable. Mm-hmm. They're anecdotal. They're private diaries, letters, ship's logs and protests. And we were able to take some of that information and get consultation from some of the best climatologists in the country and some of the world. And we put this thing together because we found that there was no single volume that had all these storms.
Right. So how did your collaboration work?
Dave and I would first meet at lunch.
Old standby.
At the cafeteria there in the Corps. And he started talking about the storm of 1812. Which somebody had said, told him, oh, you need to go look at this, because there's extensive records about that one. And he started doing the research for his paper. He wanted to start this on his own and got partway into it. And he said, would you take a look at this and tell me what it needs? So I looked at it and I said, let me write an introduction. So I wrote the introduction to the book, and he goes, you want to collaborate? So that's how it all got started.
It's nice when something evolves that naturally. Yeah. It's fun. Oh. So how far back does our written history of hurricanes really go? And I noticed that you draw on some very early Louisiana historians in this book.
Yes. We were able to trace back to a personal diary from Diron Darcadet, September 12th of 1722.
That's amazing.
And that was 4 years after the founding of New Orleans. And most of the information that we got between 1718, actually we go back a little bit further than that to 1699 at the settlement of La Blaise, right on the tip of the Delta.
I thought that was fascinating, yeah.
And all of those were fairly anecdotal, personal letters, diary entries.
And then you go back to some of the historians like LePage Duprats and Guy Ray and names that are so well known in Louisiana history. It's kind of amazing. But don't you love reading these letters?
Yes.
You know, you feel like you're there when you read them. And it's amazing how many you found that were letters to the editor of newspapers, which I thought was a riot.
Yes. We actually got more from what we would call now op-ed pieces than any other source.
Oh, it's amazing. Now, one of the things that fascinated me as I read this book was that you could really see the patterns of settlement of the city, how the city grew.
Yes.
And how much distance there was between parts of the city with some of the storms, you know, how hard it was to get information. And also how our communications have evolved over time.
Very much so, yes. Well, just from a local standpoint.
Yeah.
Communication between the communities up and down river from New Orleans was extremely difficult until they were able to build roads. It was all by river or through the swamps. So if something happened downriver, you may not hear about it for weeks or months. Upriver, same thing, but it's a little easier. Just get on the river and float down. But one of the other things that we noticed was a pattern of human behavior that's associated with responding to a disaster with protection systems, you know, at whatever level of technology they are.
Right.
Getting complacent with those measures and then getting hit again. And this is something that I don't think very many people understand, is that we've gone through that cycle over and over and over again. Five times in the 20th century, the town got hit hard. Katrina was the last one, and it was the most unusual one, of course. But the thing I noticed from afar when I lived in Atlanta was the Lower Ninth Ward was the big story. The Lower Ninth Ward got flooded five times in the 20th century.
Right. And you really bring that home in
this
book. It,
you know, we have to understand that we do what we can with these systems, but don't get complacent with these protection systems that we put in place. They're the best they've ever been right now, but nature's just got this way of overwhelming stuff.
Well, one of the things you talk about at the very beginning was that in New Orleans, so many people go back to Betsy as the big storm. And you talk about the kind of collective memory lapse that people have about that.
It kind of dovetails with what I was saying a second ago, that many people don't want to go back and look in history to see just how vulnerable this city is. Because this place is so great and it's such a wonderful place to live in, they don't want to think about it being wiped off the map. So their memory is limited. Mm-hmm. The generation that we've got right now remembers Betsy, and it was a bad one. The next generation has Katrina, and it was even worse. But pretty soon, they'll just forget about all of them.
Yeah. I'm really fascinated to see what the Katrina kids remember, you know, and how many of them stay here and move away, stuff like that.
Yes, I agree. I would like to see some study on that.
That's going to be really a telling thing about what effect that storm had. So tell us about some of the big storms that you cover in this book.
Well, there's a number of them. 1779 was a big one. That's during the Spanish rule. And they had a Governor Galvez was in power at the time, and he had a fleet ready to go upriver to attack the British at Baton Rouge. And this hurricane basically annihilated his fleet, so the British were still in power up there. 1812 was another big one, and it also involved the military. America and Britain were in the middle of a big conflict up in New England, but we had a fleet here as well. And the British were assembling a fleet to come down to New Orleans. And the hurricane of 1812 wiped out the American fleet that was sitting here. And for some reason, and we're not really clear on why, but the British did not take advantage of that. So New Orleans was spared another attack. Mm-hmm. Another very large one was the Last Island hurricane.
Oh, so famous.
Yes, in 1856. The Last Island, I think it's also Isle Denier, had a resort.
A very well-known resort.
Yes, and it was literally wiped off the island completely, right down to the foundation. Over 200 people died, and all of them from the New Orleans elite families.
And immortalized by Lafcadio Hearn.
Yes, yes. It's one of the best documented storms we have prior to 1850s. Then we have the Chenier Camandia. That was 1893. I've actually talked to some people who have families that were living there at the time and moved to like Golden Meadow and La Rose after that hurricane. And I saw in the one of the Metairie graveyards that a survivor of that storm was buried in Metairie Cemetery. It's something that you can actually put your hands on.
Yeah.
And you say, wow, I just wrote about this.
A real remnant.
Yes.
Real remnant.
Others were September 1915, a storm that damaged almost every single building in the city. Pretty much all the homes were damaged in some way, either by wind or flood. It was the first time that homeowners had to put up with unscrupulous materials supply.
Oh, wow.
And contractors to rebuild their homes. That's the first time it was ever noted officially.
God, we're almost 100 years into that.
Yes. I think other than Katrina, the biggest storm since 1915 was in 1947. Mm-hmm. And the estimated wind speed was 112 miles an hour with gusts up to 125. Oh. This was just after the Weather Bureau was formed. So they were able to use airplanes out of Mobile, Alabama, to track the storm. This is one of the first times they were able to do this and give warning to people ahead of it. So as a result, there were very few casualties on that in that storm. I mean, it was the first time.
Wow. It really is an amazing thing when you look at the arc of it all.
Yes.
So tell us your New Orleans story, because you came after Katrina.
Yes. I came down here as part of the rebuilding contract that two very large engineering firms in the country contracted with the U.S. government. I came down here from Atlanta in July of 06. And when I first got here, I really didn't want to stay. They put me here for a three-month contract. And after 3 weeks, I was ready to leave already. I mean, they still had some of the debris fields like out in West End. And yes, those famous refrigerators across the river behind the grain silos. It was awful. But then a man that I was working with took me out to a couple of the restaurants and some of the clubs, and he showed me what this place is really like. And it got to me. It spoke to me. And I asked my company, I said, is there any chance that this could be a permanent assignment? And they said, yes.
And time passed, and
yes.
Here you are.
Yes.
Well, we've been talking with Nicholas Meese, whose new book is New Orleans Hurricanes from the Start. Perfect reading for this busy month. You can meet him Wednesday, September 10th at 7 o'clock at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Thank you so much, Nick.
Happy to be here.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Michael Petry signs his novel, Fives and 25s, Tuesday, August 26th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Friday, August 29th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Novelist Mark Powell reads from and signs The Sheltering, Thursday, August 28th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Musician Sally Michelle Jackson discusses her two new books, A Darker Side of the Light, The Helsing Cases, Volume 1, and Never Stop Dreaming, Thursday, August 28th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Bob Rogers reads from and signs his novel, The Laced Chameleon, Saturday, August 30th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Jess Walter's Beautiful Ruins, Tuesday, September 2nd at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. Clayton Delery Edwards signs The Upstairs Lounge Arson, 32 Deaths in a New Orleans Gay Bar, June 24, 1973. And Gregory Alexander signs The Holy Mark, The Tragedy of a Fallen Priest, Saturday, August 30th from 7 to 9 at FAB, Faubourg Marigny Art and Books. Three new local authors discuss and sign copies of their books, Tuesday, September 2nd at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Taniska Wilson signs her short story collection, Proclivity. Cynthia Addison signs her story collection, The Devil Hates Marriages. And Ray Woodruff signs her memoir, Born Special. The Great Books Discussion Group has announced its reading list for the 2014-2015 season. The group meets at 7 on the first and third Tuesdays of each month at the Old Metairie Branch Library, 2350 Metairie Road. No registration required. The first book for the September 2nd meeting is Plato's The Crito. Today's guest, Katie Simpson Smith, signs The Story of Land and Sea, Wednesday, September 3rd at 7 at the Columns Hotel, 3811 St. Charles Avenue, at an event sponsored by Maple Street Bookshop. And again, Thursday, September 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Nicholas Meese, signs New Orleans Hurricanes from the Start, Wednesday, September 10th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library. Heather Graham's Writers for New Orleans takes place August 29th through 31st at the Hotel Monteleone. If you're an aspiring writer, especially of genre fiction, this is a good conference for you, with panel discussions and opportunities to meet editors and agents. Among the authors slated to attend, in addition to Heather Graham, are Julie Smith, Jacqueline Michard, and Chris Mooney. Check out writersfornewOrleans.com for more information or to register. And don't forget, the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library book sale continues every Wednesday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Latter Library Carriage House. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.